Uncovering the Bronze Age, Episode 4. Welcome to Planet Bob. Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of Uncovering the Bronze Age. I'm your host, Emily, and this episode is about 3 months late. No big surprise there, except that this is actually a direct follow-up to episode 13 of Michael Bradley's podcast, Superman and Batman, where we talked about World's Finest issue 215. In that episode, we looked at the first appearance of a concept that he felt was a quintessential part of the early Bronze Age, but I had never heard of, the Super Sons. If you haven't listened to the episode, I highly recommend that you do so, since a lot of my points in this episode are going to revolve around comparison to their first appearance, or build on points that I made in the earlier episode. Also, it's an awesome episode, and a great show, so you should be listening to it anyway. But before we get too far into the discussion of one of Bob Haney's most interesting creations, let's take a look at some feedback. I knew that my last issue would spark some controversy, but I was actually surprised how little knee-jerk reaction there was. A little gentle ribbing on Facebook and a couple ironic tweets. But aside from that, people seemed to get that even though I was being critical, I didn't want to be mean or disrespectful to the King's work. I may have been intentionally a little bit snarky, but I did try to give analysis and not just criticisms, and I think that a lot of people got that. In fact, the only piece of feedback criticizing my criticism comes from Luke Giaconetti, who writes, "Defaming the king? This will not stand!" I kid. Thanks for your episode taking a look at an issue of Jack Kirby's Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen. That is a really awful title to say, I've just realized. Anyway, the series is the only one of the Fourth World connected books that I have not read, but the general sense of introducing as much stuff as possible seems to be consistent. I'm a fan of the King's work in pretty much every era he worked in, including those heady books from the 1970s, which to me is marked by some unbridled creativity and a lack of editorial oversight. A lot of these Kirby books from the era were like getting unfiltered stuff straight from the King's sketchbook. I do not agree with your reading of the issue as anti-counterculture, though. Kirby, besides being fascinated with youth and youth culture, was generally one to promote and celebrate it. Jack and his wife Roz often had their home, which doubled as Jack's studio, open to young adults for discussion and intellectualizing. And I'm sure some fan wonder, considering Jack's work's ongoing popularity on college campuses. Now, having not read the issue, I can't say for sure, but to me it sounds somewhat similar to his book Forever People. That series was also collected in the same trade with the Jimmy Olsen issues and the first issues of Mr. Miracle, New Gods, etc. So I gave those a quick skim as well, and yeah, the series seemed pretty similar. So I think that Luke drawing comparisons from Forever People is pretty accurate. When Jack throws around terms like weirdos and dropouts in that book, it's done so in an ironic sense. He's almost saying, we call these kids hurtful names, but they're no threat. In fact, the major theme of the Fourth World is the concept of free will and freedom of choice, since that's what the anti-life equation would eliminate in the universe. But again, having not read this particular issue, that's a generalization. I appreciate you taking a critical look at the comic, even if you decided that you didn't like it. As I've said many times before, quoting Philbin from Phantom of the Paradise, a song is a song, you either dig it or you don't. Thanks again for the fun episode, and looking forward to what comes next, Luke. Well, thanks for writing in, Luke. Your comment about Jack having his studio open to be this sort of pseudo-philosophical hangout place for teenagers and young adults actually does make a lot of sense. In my coverage of the issue, I talked about how it just left me feeling weird. And even the stuff that I criticized for not getting youth culture, it just always felt off to me, and I couldn't quite figure out why. And I think some of that comes into a sort of question of voice in a literary sense, that it was really hard for me to tell if this weird paternalistic vibe I was getting was coming from Jack's opinions or words that Jack was putting into the mouth of Superman and some of the other adult characters, or if it was just sort of a crossed streams, misreading context 40 years later sort of thing. And judging from Luke's encyclopedic knowledge of Jack Kirby, it fortunately seems to have been a little bit of a combination of the last two. I get what he's saying about using terms like that ironically, and I guess maybe I'm just somewhat sensitive to it. I've written papers about marginalized groups on the internet and women in geek subcultures and things like that, so I take a lot of notice when those sorts of themes crop up in a story. But even with all this said, I think some of my points about Jack Kirby not getting it still hold true, but not in any sort of negative sense. My dad actually pointed this out when I was bouncing ideas off of him to try and crystallize what I wanted to say about the story and how it made me feel and why I felt so weird about it. And the point he made is that Kirby is like a cool dad. And I think that's actually pretty accurate because, in my opinion, dads are coolest when they don't try to be one of the hip kids, you know? So I think that some of Kirby's attempts either at representation or visibility or whatever, just making characters from these subgroups that weren't being seen in comics, is admirable, but it still rings a little hollow to me that even though he does like these people, he isn't one of them, and there is just something that's ever so slightly off in it. And again, this was just two issues. It was the start of an arc. It was his first attempts at doing anything like this. So of course it's going to be a little bit rough. I might come back and look at some Forever People, maybe some of the later issues, several episodes down the line. Because I would like to go back and look at a series that's addressing these issues, especially if, as Luke implies, there is this whole theme about the importance of subcultures. That would be really interesting to see if I can relate to it 40 years later, you know? But I don't really want to come back to Jack Kirby too soon, too early in his career. I'll give the King some time to settle into DC before I go and look at any more of his books. And not to dismiss how much I love Luke's regular listenership and feedbacking, the next bit of feedback is the one that really made my week. From Noel of the I Hate Love Remakes podcast. Glad to hear you enjoy the show. Thank you very much. I don't dislike this issue as much as you do, but your criticisms are absolutely right. The Fourth World Saga would grow into something spectacular, even under Jack's reign, but it got off to one hell of an awkward and jumbled start. The Jimmy Olsen issues don't work for exactly the reasons you state. A lack of focus, bringing in the Newsboy Legion Mach 2 for no reason. This thread would get even worse a few issues in as a gaggle of clones start running around, and that is the other reason that I chose the two issues I talked about. I knew I had to talk about Jimmy Olsen, at least in some capacity, and I refused to even touch the clones. He was also stuck in a title he had to shoehorn his ideas into, and trying to represent and tackle social issues in youth and hippie culture. And here Noel encapsulates the point that I think I was sort of trying to make about how this just felt off. Jack isn't a social writer, he's a mythic writer. And when the titles finally flip over into the new gods and their ilk, that's him fully within his wheelhouse, pouring his dynamic imagination straight onto the page. And that just perfectly sums up the disconnect that's in this book, because the Bronze Age, at least to me, is really typified by the social writers and Denny O'Neill and all that, you know? So that's what I expect when I want a Bronze Age book. And I also do love all of Jack Kirby's mythic stuff. But Jack isn't really even on the golden, silver, bronze age axis whatsoever. While he certainly evolves as a writer and as an artist, they don't really correlate to changes happening in, like, the comics market. Jack is just sort of doing whatever interests him, whenever it interests him. He then recommends if I want to talk about more Jack Kirby, I should look at The Demon. And that is something that I definitely do want to look at. I am a big fan of the character of The Demon. So I would definitely love to take a look at some of the earlier stuff and just see how this character kind of came to be and how much he's changed in the 40 years since. Noel then closes up the email by saying that he likes the show, looks forward to hearing more. And even though his exposure to the Bronze Age is limited, this seems like a nice place to learn a thing or two. Thank you so much for commenting and letting me know what you were thinking about this episode, Noel. I love I Hate Love Remakes, as well as a bunch of the related Made a Fail podcasts. And as for learning things on this show, well, you get to learn things as I learn them. Mostly from Luke, Jack, and Eddie. Now that the formalities are out of the way, let's take a quick break, I'll play a promo, and then we'll come back to my coverage of World's Finest issue 216, the second appearance of the Super Sons of Batman and Superman.
Wow, I'm really glad I decided to pony up and take my wife to Italy for her birthday. The food, the sights, the atmosphere, it's all just so perfect. Too bad I had to ask if there was a comic book shop located at the Vatican. Maybe it wasn't the brightest thing to do on her birthday, but granted, I'm certain I've done things way more foolish than that.
Good afternoon.
Gah! Where did you come from, and who the heck are you?
My name is Dufo DiManzo, and where I come from is none of your concern. What is of your concern is that I have an offer to make of you, an offer that you should not refuse.
Okay, what is it?
I have listened to your podcasts, and it just so happens that I am in the podcasting business myself. Someday I will ask a favor of you, one that I hope you will repay to me in good faith. When you do so, you will become a part of my family, and your show will prosper along with it.
Well, that sounds great. What do I need to do?
You will know when the time is right. Until then, I wish you and your lovely wife the happiest of times in my fair country.
Okay, cool. Some time has passed. And that does it for another episode of Just One of the Guys. Thanks everyone for listening, and I'll catch you all next week.
Bravo. Bravo.
Gah! Bravo. How the hell did you find me, and how did you get in my house?
Do not worry yourself with such trivial matters. I have seen your work with this podcast, and I have come to accept the favor that is owed to me.
But you never said what you wanted from me.
That is true, so let me restate it now.
Wait, what?
I have started up a brand new podcasting venture entitled Two True Freaks. I am setting them up with their own website, TwoTrueFreaks.com, and I am gathering a podcast such as yours that have gained my favor to become a part of the Two True Freaks podcast network. I will do the honor of putting the Just One of the Guys on the Two True Freaks network, and in return, our debt will be settled.
Oh, okay. Hey, wait, what debt?
Do you accept my offer?
Sure. I mean, does this mean I'll get paid for the show finally?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, does it mean that I'll get some cannoli?
Of course. The DiManzo family originated cannoli. In fact, we are known the world over for our stuffing of creamy fillings in the tubes.
Come check out Just One of the Guys every Friday at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Our story is Little Town with a Big Secret, from the pages of World's Finest number 216, cover dated March 1973. Written, of course, by Bob Haney, pencils by Dick Dillon, inked by Murphy Anderson. Our story begins, as many of the Super Sons stories do, with the ghostly figures of an impotent Batman and Superman clutching their heads and desperately trying to warn their sons that they are traveling into certain doom! I talked about this some in the episode of Superman and Batman, but both of the super dads are not just overbearing, but almost pathologically insane when it comes to their sons' choices. They're either desperately trying to dissuade them from becoming heroes because they don't trust they can handle it, or pushing their own agendas and methods on their clearly reticent sons. Fortunately, this is the only appearance that either character makes in the entire story, and that is definitely for the best. The main action of the splash page actually picks up right where the previous issue left off, with Clark Jr. and Bruce Jr. riding the open road on Bruce's motorcycle. But after days of traveling the open roads of America, the boys are dying for hamburgers and a chance to pursue their relative interests, be it libraries or ladies. The pair take an exit toward the town of Barstow, but Clark notices that a section of the exit sign has been painted over haphazardly. He takes a peek under the paint with his X-ray vision and sees some graffiti that reads, "Orion was here." The tag intrigues Clark, but Bruce is more focused on the milk truck ahead of them, weaving back and forth across the road. When Bruce pulls alongside, they don't see anyone at the wheel, but another burst of X-ray vision reveals that the trucker has fallen asleep. Clark tells Bruce that he's bailing out, as Bruce loses control of the bike and swerves off the road into a ditch. Clark lands on the back of the tanker and shakes the truck to wake the driver up. That does the trick, and the trucker rouses himself, completely unaware that he ever even left his lane. Clark jumps off the truck and goes to find Bruce, who has made friends with a local prairie dog. Clark laughs at his friend's misfortune, but Bruce doesn't take the joke well. He dusts himself off, muttering that while his buddy got to do the heroics, he was left trying to save their ride from the scrap heap. Clark lifts the bike back onto the road as he tries to apologize, but Bruce says he's tired of his adolescent with a heavy problem act. Clark yells back that he's tired of the big hipster act, too. Once a playboy, always a spoiled pain, I say. The two almost descend into a fist fight right there on the side of the road, when Bruce realizes this is nuts. They don't want to fight, they've just been on the road too long. Clark agrees, and they get back on the bike and head into town to find a change of pace. But looking around Barstow, they see the place is falling apart. Moreover, they don't see a single person on the street. They finally catch sight of a little boy on a porch, who waves at them. But when they say hello, the boy's mother rushes out and pulls him back inside. "Don't talk to strangers, or I'll send you to the Iceman," she says. The boy looks terrified and replies, "No, Mommy, not that. I'll be good." The Super Bros are slightly disturbed by this interaction. Bruce has heard of parents frightening their kids with all kinds of boogeymen, but an Iceman? Clark quips that maybe the guy that delivers ice is just kind of a jerk. As they pull into the gas station, they see the milk truck that Clark saved. The driver is conversing with the gas station attendant about how important this milk is for the kids of Barstow. Bruce asks Clark if he's getting the same weird vibes, and he replies, "Yeah." Clark also knows that they're lying. There isn't any milk in that truck. It's filled with liquid, all right, but at hundreds of degrees below zero. When I lifted the truck, the metal was so cold it would have burned ordinary flesh. The only thing liquid at that temperature is gas, like nitrogen or oxygen. Bruce wonders what the milkman's game is when the attendant comes over to shoo the boys on their way. Bruce says they'll go, just as soon as they've had a decent burger, and are directed toward the local diner. There they meet the diner's owner, Sweeper Wyatt, and glad to meet a friendly face at last, the boys ask, what's happened to the town? Mr. Wyatt bemoans the town's luck. First the mines gave out, then the missile base closed. Now all the old folks die off and the young ones move away. Yes, sir, Barstow's fading away. Our heroes head into the dingy diner, and Bruce, ever the smooth talker, introduces them to the pretty young waitress. Hi, beautiful. I'm Bruce, the lover, and this is Clark, the reader. Two burgers. Rare. She quips back, well, I'm Linda, the cooker, and I prefer readers to lover. Ooh, swing and a miss, Brucey. But not one to let a strikeout get under his skin, Bruce points out that both of them are out of luck, since Linda has a picture hanging on the wall of herself with a young man named Gar Orion. Linda bursts into tears as she says that he was her boyfriend. He's dead. Bruce is instantly mortified and tries to apologize and comfort Linda, but three local toughs don't like him making a gal cry. They try to rough him up, but he is Batman Jr., and headbutts one of the men in the gut, taking him out with a quip. Linda looks horrified and tries to get Clark to help his friend, or he'll be hurt. But Clark knows Bruce can take care of himself, no problem, and seems more interested in this picture that started the whole fight, examining it with telescopic vision. Part 2 opens with Bruce in full Robin mode, kicking the two remaining locals in the face simultaneously, holding himself up on a bar stool. He even lets loose a kick out of this line and groans at his own quip. I guess that's his equivalent of a dad joke. Bruce takes his seat back with a sarcastic, "Whew, the things that happen when you ask for a burger in this town. Thanks for the help, Clark, old buddy." Clark replies, "You're the lover and the fighter, remember, Bruce?" Linda's still upset and blames herself for the fight. Sweeper doesn't want to be unfriendly, but suggests that maybe it would be best if the boys left town. Bruce calls Sweeper a right dude, because even though I do love the writing in this book, it's still Haney, and the Super Sons clear out quick. A mile outside of town, they've made camp, and Bruce pulls out their costumes. Clark is surprised. I thought this was going to be a vacation from our secret identities. What gives? Something seems funny back in Barstow, buddy. The phony milk truck, uptight people in a ghost town, kids scared of a frigid bogeyman. It all adds up to something weird. Clark picked up on something else strange. And Linda's boyfriend's name was Orion, just like the graffiti. And even weirder, in that picture, Linda had a shadow, but he didn't. Barstow didn't welcome Clark and Bruce. Now it's time to see how they feel about Superman Jr. and Batman Jr. The young crime fighters split up to search for clues. Superman Jr. follows the tracks of the phony milk truck as it turns off the highway, until they simply vanish in the middle of a field. He scans the area, not seeing anything underground, but keeps circling the area just in case. But the Teen of Steel is not alone. An ominous figure observes through some binoculars, and even though he can't quite make it out, he goes to warn the others that what they feared has finally arrived. Meanwhile, Batman Jr. is prowling around the Barstow Cemetery, as the Batman do. He notices something odd. The most recent graves are from 4 years ago, and stranger still, there are no names on the three white slabs. Sweeper said that the old folks had been dying out, but if that's true, they weren't buried. Skulking back into town, Bruce sees that the undertaker's office is boarded up, and searching through files in the town hall, he stumbles across something called the Golden Tomorrow Fund. Suddenly, the room lights up as a searchlight shines through the window. Someone's wise to the young Caped Crusader's presence. He attempts an escape through the window, but is clocked in the side of the head by a guy who is waiting for him. Staggered by the blow, he manages to stay on his feet and narrowly avoids the local sheriff and his men. Ditching his costume in a trash can, Bruce heads for the only place open at this late hour, Sweeper's Diner. The staff is surprised to see Bruce still hanging around town, but as he lays down his charm on Linda yet again, he notices something odd. Her picture is missing. Linda won't look at Bruce and tries to brush off his questions, but he persists. Come on, doll. The picture of you and your, late boyfriend, Gar Orion. Sweeper subtly hints that Bruce is asking too many questions. At that moment, the sheriff and his goons burst in and arrest Bruce. He protests, but the sheriff has evidence. That gun butt crease on your forehead proves you were the one breaking into City Hall. Bruce, in a moment of genuine quick thinking, claims that it was from the fight that afternoon, but Sweeper pokes holes in that defense. Now, son, I'm your friend, but those louts never laid a hand on you. Besides, the sheriff represents law and order. If you're innocent, you got nothing to fear. Bruce tries to protest his innocence to Linda, but she still won't look him in the eye. As the cuffs are snapped on, he thinks, I could fight my way out of this, but this is the law around here. Better go quietly and see what develops. That's what Dad would do. Sometime later, Clark has shown up to pay his buddy's bail and maybe rub his nose in the situation just a bit. Hi, Brucey. How's the lover? What you won't go through for a burger. However, as soon as Clark steps over the threshold, the sheriff slams the door behind him, locking in both troublemakers. When they point out there's no charges against Clark, the sheriff taps his gun. That's all the charges he needs around here. As he leaves the two teens to rot, they compare notes and try to figure what in the hell is at the root of what's rotten in Barstow. Shortly, they ruminate on how to get out of jail. Clark could bust them out, but Bruce reminds him that they need to protect their secret identities. Clark mutters that he wishes their dads were on the case. He'd gladly trade some youthful zing for their experience. Fortunately, Linda the cooker arrives at their barred window to apologize for her actions. She's just so afraid. Bruce presses her for more information, and Linda reveals that they forced her to lie. Otherwise, they would destroy her, just like they did to Gar. However, the explanation is cut off as a group of men spot her and drag her away off-panel to meet the Iceman. Clark bends the bars on the window, and the super bros slip out. Clark thoughtfully straightening the bars again, to leave a mystery for the sheriff and his cronies to wonder about in the morning. Clark follows the milk truck along the same route it took earlier, but the dust kicked up in the truck's wake makes him sneeze, and he shoots himself a half mile backwards. By the time he catches up again, the truck has vanished. Again. Scouring the field with his X-ray vision, Superman Jr. has a realization. He doesn't just see nothing underground, he can't see anything underground. Realizing there's a lead plate blocking his view, Superman Jr. thrusts his hand into the ground and pulls, revealing a trapdoor entrance to the closed-down missile silo. He leaps into the abyss, and behind a door marked Control Chamber, finally discovers part of the town's secret. Everyone in town, young and old, are frozen in cryogenic capsules using the liquid nitrogen pumped in from the milk truck. Part 3 opens with a scientist, the eponymous Iceman, forcing Linda into an open cryogenic pod with the help of the sheriff's men. She protests. I wasn't to go for weeks yet. You're doing this to punish me. They say this is the only way to ensure that she wouldn't betray them to the strangers. Besides, it won't hurt, if she cooperates. Superman Jr. leaps into action, demanding that the men release Linda immediately. However, the scientist grabs one of the hoses and opens it full blast at Superman Jr. Caught off guard, he struggles to resist the numbing shockwave of cold, but only manages to stagger a few steps before his molecules slow to the point that he is no longer stronger than a mere mortal. And a second later, you froze him! You monsters! It was necessary, the sheriff replies. The outside world must not learn of what we do here. Now it's your turn, girl. Meanwhile, on the outskirts of town, Batman Jr. dismounts his motorcycle to investigate a burnt-out ruin, all that remains of the Orion homestead. He found the records in City Hall. They moved into town only a short while before their son's death. But what about the parents of the boy with no shadow? Suddenly, the young Batman is struck by a flash of inspiration. What a bubble brain I've been! Those 3 tombstones didn't cast shadows either. And I think I know why the whole Orion family is buried under them, in nameless graves, as if their deaths were suspicious. Musing over the clues, Batman Jr. notices a strange gizmo among the wreckage, something like a compass, but pointing southwest. Following his hunch, Batman Jr. races to where the needle points, arriving in a dead-end canyon in the nearby hills. And there, nestled among craggy stones, is a giant, shimmering, seamless object. A UFO. Suddenly a pebble skitters behind him, and Bruce whips around to see Sweeper Wyatt menacing him with a shotgun. Bruce figured that he would be involved somehow, and Sweeper replies, "Don't know how you found it, fella, but it'll do you no good. Now raise those hands if you want to keep on living. That sphere belongs to the people of Barstow." Batman Jr. retorts, "It belonged to the Orions before you killed them, Sweeper." Sweeper doesn't deny the accusation. "I didn't kill him alone. The whole town had a hand in it." He proceeds to recount the tale, how a nice family moved into town from out of state several years back. They seemed like nice folk, until their boy Gar decided to show off to impress his girlfriend, Linda. Turns out he had the ability to pass through solid objects because he and his family are not Earthlings, but from space. The constellation Orion, to be precise. Linda got scared and told her folks. Soon the whole town was up in arms. Some are disgusted, others horrified. "They look and act just like us." "Yeah, that's what's so scary." Barstow had had a run of bad luck. The missile base closing, freakish weather, a bunch of accidental deaths. And soon a lynch mob was loosed, blaming the Orions for everything that had gone wrong in town. "I was in that mad crowd, as was most of the town. When we reached the Orion home, Gar's father faced us. Mr. Orion tries to appease the crowd. He and his family were marooned on Earth when their ship malfunctioned, locking them out while it repaired itself over the next 25 years. Until then, they only wished to live peacefully, as Earth's guests. "We mean you no harm, for are we all not children of the universe?" He begs them to put aside their anger, and even offers to reward the mob with riches from the ship before they leave, if only they will be left in peace. Unfortunately, the plea falls on dead ears. Guess his strange talk and the crowd's mood was like gasoline and matches. Suddenly, the Orion house was ablaze. Some people come to their senses, horrified by dooming this family to burn alive, but others feel it serves them right. Back in the 1970s present, Batman Jr. spells out the rest of the town's plan. They all felt guilty about the murders, but rather than facing the punishment of Earth, or possibly retribution from the Orion homeworld, they decided to phase out the town, spending most of the town budget on cryogenics, until the UFO opened in 1994. Then they could plunder the ship for the riches Orion had promised them. Until then, Sweeper and his co-conspirators worked to erase every trace of the Orion presence, including painting over the graffiti and destroying Linda's picture. Sweeper admits that they couldn't bring back the Orions,
But using the treasure, they could one day rebuild the town, at least. After all, why should they all suffer for Barstow's one bad night? Because you burned three people to death in their own house, asshole! Batman tries to convince Sweeper to give up this crazy plan, but he says it's too late. The last citizens are now on ice, and the young Dark Knight is going to join them. When they arrive at the missile base, Batman Jr. is shocked to see both Linda and his buddy have already been frozen. Sweeper reveals he was the one spying on Junior Soups, and that he originally mistook him for Avengers from the Orion's planet. That's why they had to speed up the phase-out. Now the only people left in town are Sweeper, Bruce, Iceman, and the Sheriff. Sweeper gestures toward the pod with his shotgun, and Bruce thinks that this is his last chance. If he can't get himself and Clark out of this mess, they'll wake up 2 decades in the future, and their parents might even be dead by then. Bats 2 makes his move. Sure, I'll go, followed by you and the Sheriff, leaving Sweeper last, so he can have the treasure for himself. The Sheriff doesn't believe him. Why wouldn't Sweeper freeze himself with the rest of them, since the ship won't open again for 20 years? Wrong, Sheriff. It'll open sooner. Much sooner. And Sweeper knows it. Mr. Orion miscalculated the strength of Earth's magnetic fields. Have either of you two actually been near the ship? Because I have. And my watch hands accelerated like crazy, days going by in minutes. Sweeper, too, must have noticed the difference. Sweeper threatens to shoot Batman Jr. up, but the Sheriff pulls a gun on him and tells Batman Jr. to keep going. Sweeper had checked out books on astrophysics and space-time theory. Judging from the notes he made in the margins, the ship could open at any time. That's really why he wanted to speed up the phase-out. He never intended to join the rest of Barstow in the deep freeze, but grab the ship's treasure and take off with it. Sweeper cocks his gun, but the Iceman shoots him with the liquid nitrogen, freezing him solid in an instant. The Iceman then asks, "But what now? If the ship's due to open, I can thaw everyone out. Barstow could rebuild itself with the treasure right now." But the Sheriff seems deflated, now that they've been found out. "Sure, but we'll be exposing ourselves to justice, or maybe vengeance from space, to say nothing of our own guilty consciences." At that moment, the ground shakes, and a building rumble can be heard from nearby. The three of them run outside just in time to see the ship taking off as it races back into the stars. The Sheriff and the scientists stand dumbfounded as the treasure they ransomed their futures to returns to where it came from, the faraway home of the Orions. Sometime later, Iceman and the Sheriff have released everyone from their cryogenic slumbers. The Sheriff says that Barstow's returned to life and facing the consequences of its one bad night. The governor pardoned the town for the Orions' deaths, and Sweeper Wyatt's gone, a discredited wanderer. The scientist declares that in return, they guarantee that their town will always welcome any traveler or stranger with open arms. As Mr. Orion said, "We're all Earthlings and aliens, children of the universe." As the Supersons prepare to leave town, Linda looks sadly off into the distance as she thinks about poor Bruce and Clark and all that the town put them through. She wonders how they ever managed to escape from the jail, and the boys reply, "Maybe they were insubstantial beings too, Linda. Anyway, I've got a hunch you'll be seeing them again one day." And shortly thereafter, our story ends, the same way it began, as Bruce and Clark ride off into the distance, to new adventures, leaving Barstow and Sweeper Wyatt's broom in the dust. Well, there's still a lot to talk about with this one, so right now we'll take a quick break, play another promo for another podcast, and when we come back, we'll look at some of the sociological implications that this story raises, along with the characters of Clark and Bruce Jr.'s, and the way this story compares and contrasts to the one from last episode.
If you're a diehard X-Files fan, join me, Agent Shadow.
And me, Agent Chelsea.
As we cover all X-Files episodes and movies one by one. Just search iTunes for X-Files and subscribe to X-Files Truth.
Before we get too far into the actual discussion of the issue, I want to bring something up in relation to my release schedule. This episode, of course, was supposed to be recorded and released as an immediate follow-up to Michael Bradley's episode 13 of Superman and Batman. That obviously did not happen. Now, my release schedule is sort of spotty in general, but this one in particular was plagued with some fairly severe technical issues, as well as just some unfortunate timing for various family affairs and then my getting of a job, which cut down on my podcasting time pretty significantly. Some of those technical difficulties I mentioned before resulted in me having to re-record this episode in a couple parts a couple of times, hence the somewhat weird audio quality. I've done my best to smooth it out as much as possible, but another one of those technical difficulties is that I don't currently have Audacity, so that has made the editing and mixing and mastering of this also somewhat difficult. All of those things combined to make this episode come out approximately 3 months late. I'm getting a little tired of constantly apologizing for how slow my release schedule is, so I'm actually going to take a page from the book of aforementioned fellow podcaster Noel Thingvall, and just say that this show is going to be released on a quarterly basis. If I'm feeling really inspired, or if I have a week off from work, or if I'm just really on a roll, or if the download numbers are down, maybe I'll release episodes a little bit more frequently, but expect them every 3 months or so. Now, apologies made, explanations given, let's get on to the analysis. I'm actually somewhat glad that this episode couldn't come out in April when I originally intended it to be released, because I'm a little worried people might have thought that I was joking. It was just supposed to be a late April Fool's Day prank. But I love this issue, unapologetically. I think this is great. Which is a little bit ironic, considering how much I hated last episode's issue of Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, because there's a lot of stuff in common between these two stories. Our primary characters are teenagers, created by an older man with a long-standing history of writing comics since the really early days. Our new characters are sons of former characters with the same names, powers, or roles as their fathers. Something that I described in the last episode in reference to the Newsboys as the laziest, dumbest comic book trope in all of history. The dialogue in both are full of slang that sounds like it was written by an alien with babelfish. And of course, what story from the 70s is complete without teenagers on motorcycles? So, why don't I hate this thing? Well, first of all, I think the quality of writing. Now, bear with me on this one. Regardless of his tendency for silly plots or characters and the bizarre lexiconography that Haney uses for his teenaged characters, dialogue really is his strong suit. Furthermore, I think that the pacing is excellent. The way that the story builds on itself, creating a pretty well-seeded and explained mystery that, when it does turn out in the end to be aliens, it doesn't feel like typical Bob Haney dumb zaniness. It feels more like an X-Files episode, which was the comparison I kept coming back to as I was reading this. Also, the character relationships seemed a lot more realistic to me. Maybe it's just because I am in my mid-20s, but the friendship between Bruce Jr. and Clark Jr. seemed really genuine to me, and a lot of their bickering sounded like me hanging out with my friends, even with the crazy, uber-cool, hip kid speak. The references to hipster and playboy and Bruce's calling out of Clark as a nerd, that seemed like the type of dialogue and relationships and friendships that those kind of characters would have. Because they are teenagers, well, more like 22-year-olds, and they are kind of hipster punks. They're trying to act cool. They're trying to establish that they're awesome. And I legitimately laughed out loud at their comedy double act. Little things like Bruce flirting with Linda was genuinely funny. Whenever Clark would play straight man and make fun of Bruce's cavalier ways, it was legitimately funny. That seemed like the type of dialogue and relationships and friendships that those kind of characters would have. But I also totally believed that these two cared about each other. That's something that I never felt with any of the cast of thousands in Kirby's Jimmy Olsen. Furthermore, at least to me, it felt like there was less of a reliance on stereotypes, even or maybe especially with our leads. When you have a story about a young Superman and Batman, which is really what this is, it's really easy to just say, well, they're exactly like their parents. I think that's a cop-out, which is why I loathe the Newsboy Legion so much. Since it's now been 3 months, I can't remember if I mentioned in that episode, but my abiding feeling after I was done with that story that I repeated to my dad ad nauseum out of frustration, I wish they'd just been time travelers. And only in comic fandom is that a common sentiment. What Kirby really wanted was to write those same characters from the 40s, but instead of finding a way to bring those characters from the 40s back into continuity, he just created new characters that were exactly the same. And I can't say that that is true for Superman and Batman Jr., that Bruce Jr. is a different character from his father. In their first appearance, you get this sense that Bruce Jr. is really lax, cavalier, and laid back because he was raised as the son of Bruce Wayne, not of Batman. So he's willing to make jokes, he's kind of lazy, and yes, he does love the ladies. But unlike with Bruce Wayne, it doesn't feel as much like a cover. On the other hand, Clark Jr. is seen to have a really big chip on his shoulder about being the son of Superman. And it totally makes sense. Think about it. If you have known for your entire life that you have superpowers, that's one thing. But to then constantly be measuring yourself to your father and finding yourself wanting, that creates some general pathos. And something that I like is that Clark, Superman Jr., is actually kind of angry, especially in his first appearance, less so in later appearances. But I thought that was actually an interesting place to go to root a character in, that yes, he does have an inferiority complex, even though he has superpowers. And I don't want this to sound like I'm ragging on Jack Kirby any more than I did for an hour last episode. But at the heart of it, Kirby's not a writer, he's an artist. And thus, I always find his stories where he relies on his art to be a lot more interesting than stories where he's trying to have relatable characters. It's just not his strong suit in the same way that epic tales of heroes and gods and monsters are. And while I would never call Bob Haney a genius or influential in the same way that Jack Kirby does, we have found the rare comic in which a Haney story is miles ahead of a Kirby story in quality. Since we're already speaking about art, let's dig into that a little bit. Michael and I talked a little bit about our mild distaste for Dick Dillon's artwork in issue 215, and especially the way that he drew the Super Sons' faces. But issue 216 just serves as evidence for how vital your inker is, since this issue has almost none of the artistic problems that I had with the previous one. With Murphy Anderson there to clean up the faces and make sure everything looks good and consistent and proportional, it leaves Dick Dillon free to focus on what he's really great at, which is the layouts and the action sequences. Though it isn't Team Swanderson, I was really glad to have Murphy Anderson back on this show. It's that perfect blend for me of detail and simplicity that I look for in comic art, where it conveys the story in a realistic enough sense that I can relate to it. The actual character designs for our lead heroes haven't changed, per se, from issue 215, but again, they just feel cleaner and crisper, more intentional, and a little less like, what would Superman and Batman look like when they were 22? Though Superman and Batman only appear in the first page of this issue, I didn't have any of the problem that I had in issue 215 with not being able to tell the difference between Superman and Superman Jr., or Batman and Batman Jr. if they were on the page at the same time. The sons look like their fathers, but not like clones. And as for character designs, I appreciated that even though this story has about 6 primary characters, all of them look distinct. Even though Mr. Orion only shows up for about a page and a half, he is a uniquely designed character, well drawn. Same thing for our villains, Sweeper Wyatt, the Iceman, and the Sheriff. Also, Linda the Cooker is one of my new favorite random side characters. I adore her. And it's really unfortunate, I think, that the Super Sons would never actually get to keep their promise to return to Barstow at any point during their run. As for the plot, I already mentioned in my overview that I really enjoyed it, especially the pacing and the way that the mystery was unveiled. But there was something about this issue that just really spoke to me. It feels almost like the Superman Walks story that we could have had. Sort of. Personally, I'm a big fan of stories that juxtapose the mundane and the fantastic. Now, you could say that includes all sorts of superhero comics in general, but I mean it a little more specifically. I love the idea, for example, that Natasha takes White Tiger out for coffee and sushi after work, or the idea that Superman would put everything on hold for one night to spend Christmas on the farm with his parents. Basically, I like it when characters are not just equally involved with, but equally gratified by both sides of their lives. I think the idea of the separate secret identity is a little bit overplayed in the modern consciousness than it actually is in the stories, at least in the stories that I like. In this World's Finest issue, we basically just get a story of two boys on a road trip that get into crazy hijinks. Also, they happen to have superpowers. In my recap, I referred to both of our heroes as Bruce and Clark respectively, even if they were in costume. I'm sorry if that was a little bit confusing. Obviously, Bruce is not Bruce when dealing with the villains, secret identity and all. But that's because both have very fluid identities. Yes, I have been listening to the Arkham Sessions podcast. Thanks for noticing. Basically, they act the same, whether they're in or out of costume, and have the same playfully dickish relationship with one another. And that relationship is absolutely the best thing in this story. I officially rechristened this duo the Super Bros, because that is exactly what they are. The friendship here rings so genuine. I found myself equally invested in the boys attempting to have a road trip and getting run off the road and having to fix their bike, as I was in finding out about this dark, looming secret that was menacing the town. And I think that that is a real credit to the writing. I really love the X-Files Twilight Zone-y twist that we have in this story. Everything with the townsfolk seems just slightly uncomfortable, but also realistic. It's one of those moments where the strangeness comes through much more in the way that the town appears to be normal than in anything obviously bizarre that's going on. Let's just say subtlety is rare in Haney-crafted stories, and I appreciate when it's there. Now, I have to stop singing the story's praises for a brief moment. Again, I read this story in trade, so I did not see the cover. It's something that I haven't been talking about in my previous issues as much, because that's how I'm reading most of these stories. So I haven't been addressing the covers, letter pages, or ads like some other podcasts like to do when they cover the individual issues. Most of the time, that's not a problem. But there is a little bit of an elephant in the room. If you look at the cover to issue 216 of World's Finest, You see Batman and Superman going door to door, knocking and asking if the people inside have seen their sons. The local yokel who answers the door replies, "Nope, but behind the door we can see the boys frozen in cryogenic tubes." Yep, they gave away the reveal on the cover. And since I don't know much about the way that comics publishing works in the 70s, I'm not sure if I could blame Haney for the cover that was given to his book. But it really bothers me, because this was one of the few examples of Haney putting together a subtle, well-paced, intriguing mystery that actually made total logical sense in retrospect. And they give away the ending. That fact really irks me, and it did take away a little bit of the warm, fuzzy feelings I felt for this story, but not by much, fortunately. As for the writing itself, I've already complimented it quite a bit. I love the dialogue. I love the witty comebacks. I tried to include as much of the dialogue and description into my recap as possible to give a sense that, yeah, this story is actually really well crafted, even at the sentence level. My personal favorite turn of phrase was "the hope they ransomed their futures to," in reference to the spaceship. And it just surprised me that sort of quiet, poetic moment could come out of a Bob Haney story. I suppose my standards were so low that it was easy for me to be impressed, but there you go. I was impressed. Furthermore, this is one of those comics that manages to convey movement and pace brilliantly. The things I kept comparing it to were anthology TV shows. And, much to my mom's delight, the 1970s Incredible Hulk series. Now, this is primarily for the first two issues, and I will say this, that the second issue in this trade, 216, is far and away the best story of the book. All of the other stories range from adequate to more typically Bob Haney ridiculous to not that great to sort of uncomfortable in retrospect, and one issue that pissed me off. If you've read the issue, you know which one I'm referring to. I recognize that in the 70s, the concept of writing for the trade wasn't even an idea, let alone something that a person would strive for in their story. But I think that the trade as a whole would be helped if they'd kept this framing sequence of the motorcycle. I really wanted it to turn into a sort of 1970s Hulk or Superman Walks type of story, where it would just be each issue, Bruce Jr. and Clark Jr. roll into a different town, run into a different group of people, have some sort of crazy thing happen, which would have further distinguished them from the stories of their parents, which are very much centered in Metropolis and Gotham, respectively. There's still some reference to the fact that they travel or that they've been away, but most of the other stories feel more like typical world's finest team-ups, in a slightly disappointing sense. Now, let's talk about the Twilight Zone-esque reveal of the Orions. This story feels almost like it was tailor-made for me, and this discussion of mob mentality and intergalactic ethics is just icing on the cake. The entire flashback sequence was surprisingly moving the first time I read it, and with Sweeper Wyatt's resigned tone in the narration, it just feels even more horrifying. The concept of mob mentality is a pretty common one, but there's another sociological term that I want to throw into the discussion: in-group, out-group mentality. This is basically a fancy way of describing the desire to sort people into capital us and them. While it's not a bad thing in itself, this social prerogative is at the root of things like segregation, xenophobia, and other forms of prejudice. This scene, for me, touched on several different issues that were real hot-button concerns at the time the story was written, and remain relevant today. First, the last of the Jim Crow laws had only been overturned 6 years before this issue came out. Many people had lived in fear of torch-wielding lynch mobs just like this one less than a decade before. Even today, there remain problems with regional segregation and concerns about increasing immigration, though those concerns rarely erupt in this type of violence. But the fear of people that are not like us remains relevant 40 years later, and likely will for decades to come. The other issue this scene reminded me of was actually the Red Scare and McCarthyism. Perhaps I've been listening to too much early Fantasticast, but the reactions of the townspeople called back feelings of the Skrull menace as metaphor for hidden communist agents. Before they move to full-on murder, we see several townspeople trying to grapple with what it means to learn there are literal aliens among them. The quote that stood out to me was, "They look and act just like us. That's what makes them so scary." The town admits that the Orions are, for all intents and purposes, normal human beings. But they're scared and angry and need a scapegoat. So by God, they're going to find one. With this context, Orion's final words, "Are we not all children of the universe?" don't feel like the cheesy "we are the world" kumbaya call for unity that it could have been. It's a desperate plea for peace, but also a hopeful sentiment that we can become better and more understanding than we are. And that feeling of hope comes through in the end, as the town recognizes their mistakes and strive to become better. In the end, the whole story is just uplifting. The comedy, character relations, tragedy, and redemption all work together to keep it from getting too dark or too silly. The mystery is great, the message is great, the art is great, and the dialogue is great. So yes, Bob Haney did it better than Jack Kirby. I can't thank Michael Bradley enough for having me on his show originally and pointing me in the direction of the Super Sons. I never would have sought them out on my own, and I would have been missing out. The irredeemable Shag Matthews has also mentioned some interest in the Super Sons trade, and if he hears this, I would say I recommend it. Most of the stories are not this complex and well-written, but the vast majority are a fun read. Provided you go into it looking for some silly Haney plots, moments of thoughtful character development, and some excellent action-based art, you won't be disappointed. And you may even uncover a hidden gem or two. Until next time, take care. This has been a Relatively Geeky production. Tune in to the Relatively Geeky podcast feed for this and our other shows, the Quarterbin Podcast and the Short Box Showcase, at www.relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, or search for Relatively Geeky or Uncovering the Bronze Age in iTunes. If you have feedback for this or any of our other shows, email us at relativelygeeky@gmail.com or leave a rating and review in iTunes. The intro music was X-Files, Uncle Variation on a Theme by Mark Snow. And the closing music, Assault on Precinct 13 Theme, 1983 version, by John Carpenter. Do-do-do-do, we're on a motorcycle!